Chapter 8. At dawn of the 1st of Muharram, once the rebels seized the mosque, Juhayman concentrated on the military side of the operation. He made sure that the gates were all locked and that his snipers controlled all approaches to the holiest shrine. Someone else was to deliver the uprising's manifesto and to explain these historic events to the world of Islam. After grabbing the imam's microphone, Juhayman yielded it to the supposed Mahdi's older brother, Saeed, whose smooth classical Arabic testified to rigorous Islamic instruction. With his pitched cadences and melodic intonations, Saeed sounded like a learned cleric, a voice of authority that immediately instilled respect. "The wicked ways of the House of Saad," the silver-tongued Saeed told believers as he stood shoulder to shoulder with Juhayman, "were a clear sign to believers that the world was coming to an end, and that Islam's final triumph over unbelief was arriving." Prince Fawaz, the king's liberal brother and the governor of Mecca, was chosen for special opprobrium for his supposed debauchery. Corruption brought by television, the pollution of minds caused by Westerners, and the employment of women sullied Islamic purity in the cradle of the only true faith. And what about the new pagan scourge of soccer that, with government complicity, steered the faithful away from Islam? The kingdom's rulers, pawns of the infidels, were unworthy of true believers' respect. The oath of Baya that Saudi subjects had given to their king was no longer valid because the royal family demonstrably failed to uphold the laws of Islam. But luckily, relief was at hand. Citing in detail the relevant hadith, Saeed outlined Juhayman's theory about the Mahdi redeeming the world of Islam. After rattling off divine signs, such as the name Muhammad Abdullah and the red birthmark on the cheek, he paused for effect and made the dramatic announcement. "The good man is here with us, and he will bring justice to earth after it had been filled with injustice. If anyone doubts, come here to check. We are all your brothers." Once this introduction was made, Muhammad Abdullah approached the center of the Grand Mosque's courtyard through a broad passage that militants had made for him in the crowd. A red checkered headdress, worn loosely over his head, flapped in the wind. He was even paler than usual, but otherwise showed little emotion. Some of the worshippers gasped at the youth of the man afforded such deference. Holding a submachine gun in his hand, Muhammad Abdullah joined Juhayman at the precise spot that had been described by the prophecies, in the shade of the Kaaba, between the graves of Ishmael and Hagar, and a boulder with the impression of Ibrahim's feet. "In the name of Allah, most gracious, most merciful, here is the awaited Mahdi," Juhayman cried. "Pay allegiance to brother Muhammad Abdullah al-Qureshi," he went on, calling the poet student by a name that, as everyone here knew, was also the one of Prophet Muhammad himself. One after another, Juhayman's gunmen knelt down to kiss Muhammad Abdullah's hand and offer the oath of Baya, uttering the same words with which early Muslims had pledged their loyalty to Prophet Muhammad. "We will obey you in weal and woe, in ease and hardship and evil circumstances, except in what would disobey God." Clasping their hands, the hostages followed suit, making the same promise. As the pledging went on, the Mahdi's brother Saeed sounded almost apologetic. "We have nowhere else to go except the Grand Mosque," he explained through the shrine's public address system. "All we ask people to do is to return to the ways of the Holy Quran and the Sunnah, even though this is against what the government and the Ulema are telling you." By the end of the hour, some of the worshippers seemed to be genuinely convinced. One Yemeni man ran to the supposed Mahdi, screaming that he too had seen him in his dreams. Others were too frightened to speak up. Having pledged the Baya, senior conspirators ferried crates full of rifles to the center of the enclosure, distributing them to ordinary militants and then to those pilgrims who had decided to join the uprising. "The army will besiege the Mahdi as he will be in the Grand Mosque," Saeed recounted from yet another hadith. "And that army is from the sons of Muhammad, made up not of Jews or Christians, but of Muslims." In addition to weaponry, stacks of Kuwaiti-printed brochures with Juhayman's writings were passed to the crowd. At this point, some confused worshippers, aware of Khomeini's desire to export the Islamic revolution to Saudi Arabia, shouted questions at Muhammad Abdullah. Was his uprising, they wanted to know, inspired by Iran? Scowling with scorn, the anointed Mahdi answered with a single emphatic no before walking away. Fellow gunmen hastened to explain that the heretical Shiites of Iran, not being true Muslims, could have no connection with this apocryphal event. With the Bay'ah oath formally switching the allegiance of Saudi worshippers from the royal family to the Mahdi, Jurhayman's gunmen began confiscating Saudi identity cards among the crowd and tearing them in half, shoving and insulting their owners. The Saudi state was illegitimate, and these documents were a sign of loyalty to Satan, the gunmen yelled. Fearful, many pilgrims rushed to destroy their IDs, littering the courtyard's marble floor with a confetti of embossed paper and torn photographs. Jurhayman's supporters also grew enraged at the sight of worry beads, favored by many Meccans, but condemned in strict Wahhabi Islam as an alien innovation. Whenever one of the gunmen came nearby, unlucky possessors of these worry beads quickly dropped them on the ground. In what seemed like a bad omen, Jurhayman's men sustained their first casualty in these first moments of the takeover. An unlucky warning shot ricocheted off a column and killed on the spot Mansur al-Qahtani, the supposed Mahdi's father-in-law. Recovering his sang-froid after being shoved away by Jurhayman, the mosque's imam, Sheikh Muhammad ibn Subayl, managed to throw off his distinctive beige cloak and vanish into the mass of pilgrims amid the initial disarray. Running for his life, the 55-year-old imam then headed to his quarters above the Fatah gate. The office, up a narrow staircase, had windows on both sides of the mosque's main circular body, overlooking the inner courtyard dominated by the Kaaba and the streets of Mecca outside. The cleric, who also served as deputy chairman of the Saudi religious body in charge of running Islam's two holy shrines in Mecca and Medina, picked up the phone and dialed his superior, Sheikh Nasser ibn Rashid. After narrating the morning's incredible events, Ibn Subayl looked out the window again and noticed that additional conspirators were entering the Grand Mosque through a passageway from the street below, in one case even driving a vehicle indoors. Having informed authorities, Ibn Subayl returned downstairs and, trying his best to remain unnoticed, strode to an office of the Grand Mosque police force. The station was located near the King Abdulaziz Gate, inside the compound, and the officer in charge had already reached a delirious state. "Have you called your commanders?" Ibn Subayl asked. "We were told that the Mahdi has come," the agitated officer replied. Shaken by the killing of two of his men earlier, he appeared to believe that the end of the world was already occurring. Ibn Subayl did his best to disabuse the officer of that notion. The Grand Mosque's usurpers were familiar to the cleric, as was the missionary movement unleashed by Bin Baz. He even recalled cautioning the parents of some of the youngsters under Jurhayman's spell. All in all, Ibn Subayl thought, these wild, gun-toting men didn't look like the kind of folk who'd produce the genuine redeemer described in the holy books of Islam. The officer in charge promised to act, though it was clear he wasn't itching for a fight. To make sure that his rank was not discovered by the rebels, he had already taken off and concealed the upper part of his uniform. With the Grand Mosque's gates remaining shut, a large crowd of worshippers who wanted to enter for prayers now formed around the shrine. One of them was a 14-year-old student in the Grand Mosque's madrasa, who will be called Samir in this book. Two of his older brothers were senior members of Jurhayman's movement, and Samir himself had already met the great man. His heart had beat so strongly during that encounter that he felt his chest was about to burst apart. Samir, whose brothers kept him in the dark about preparations for the Grand Mosque attack, had heard through the Mecca grapevine that the Mahdi should appear after the Hajj. He had made sure to spend the first few days after the pilgrimage's end in the mosque, and was deeply disappointed that nothing happened at the time. Now, 2 weeks later, he instantly understood what was going on as he heard loudspeakers broadcast the opening words of Sayyid's Bay'ah sermon. He hurried to join his two brothers and the blessed Mahdi indoors. There was still virtually no police or army presence on the streets around the mosque, and so Samir circled the compound from one closed gate to another until he hit the doorless Bin Laden Company accessway under the Fatah gate. As he ran into the dark opening, his path was barred by two armed gunmen.
They recognized Samir from meetings hosted by his brothers in the family home and warmly embraced the teenager. "Brother, come join us." Another hour or so later, by about 8 a.m., the Mecca police finally responded to the crisis. A single police jeep sent out to investigate the disturbance rolled up to the gates. The vehicle was instantly submerged in a hail of gunfire. Bullets fired by Juhayman's snipers from atop a minaret shattered the windshield. The driver, injured and bleeding, fell out of the car. By then, the rebels had started to let most of the hostages go. Having pledged the bayah to the Mahdi and having received the seven epistles, these worshippers were now supposed to become the Redeemer's envoys, spreading the good news far and wide across the lands of Islam. A torturous escape route was provided through raised windows in the lower-level gallery of the mosque. Climbing onto one another's shoulders, civilians could squeeze out through these windows, often twisting limbs in the process and emerging on street level outside the compound. It took well over a day for most of the hostages to trickle out this way. Ibn Subil, the mosque's imam, noticed that the conspirators didn't just allow everybody to leave. One young Saudi man next to him looked like a pious believer, with a short robe, a loose headdress, and a curly beard that had never been defiled by scissors. The guards barred his way out. The man's duty, they explained, was to pick up arms and join their jihad. Several other Saudis were similarly turned back. Realizing that he would have to disguise his appearance, Ibn Subil pulled down his headdress and wrapped it around his shoulders in the manner of foreigners. He then joined a group of fretful Indonesian pilgrims, trying to blend in.
Juhayman had no use for the Indonesians, who spoke no Arabic and couldn't really understand his grand plan. They were let go without harassment, and the grand mosque's imam, too, managed to slip out unnoticed.
Officials back at the Mecca police station still did not grasp the extent of the problem at the Grand Mosque. After the first jeep failed to return, a larger convoy of police cars ambled toward another side of the shrine.
Their mission bordered on suicidal. In an instant, the rebels riddled these policemen with bullets from the minarets and the upstairs windows, which were covered with intricate latticework, providing perfect cover for Juhayman's men.
By one account, 8 officers died on the spot. 36 were wounded. While the rebels' Kalashnikovs could spray death only about 300 meters around the mosque, their Belgian-made FN-FAL rifles were sufficiently powerful to kill at nearly double that distance, several city blocks away. Running for cover, the surviving policemen abandoned their vehicles and sought shelter by the mosque's outer walls. Pinned down in a small blind spot area, they were safe from the snipers atop the minarets. But they were also separated from the rest of the city by open ground now littered with bodies. By now, the desert sun started burning, and blood caked up on the asphalt. Gathering courage in the late morning, some Meccan civilians dressed in white robes, the near-mandatory clothing for Saudi males, inched behind the disabled police jeep and pulled one hemorrhaging officer to safety.
The snipers' guns remained silent. Juhayman had given his men strict orders not to shoot at civilians.
Getting bolder, other men walked toward the bolted gates and surreptitiously threw spare white robes and water bottles toward the policemen who had been trapped in the blind spot by the Grand Mosque's outer walls. One by one, the exhausted officers donned the robes, hid their guns underneath, and walked to safety on the other end of the plaza. If the snipers understood the ruse, they chose not to fire. Later, there would be claims that King Khalid himself and other senior members of the royal household were expected to attend New Year's Dawn prayers in the Grand Mosque. One version, widely reported at the time, held that the entire takeover had been timed by Juhayman in order to take King Khalid prisoner, and that only a last-minute throat infection saved the monarch from captivity. Such intentions, in fact, seemed to have been far away from the minds of the conspirators. Senior royals, they knew, were very unlikely to awaken in time to arrive in the Grand Mosque before dawn. As it happened, some very important Saudis, including senior government bureaucrats and 45 relatives of the powerful oil minister, Ahmed Zaki Yamani, did find themselves trapped inside the Grand Mosque Tuesday morning.
And at one point, Juhayman's gunmen tried to screen the crowd for familiar faces. But among the tens of thousands of hostages, the conspirators spotted no one of real importance to the House of Saad.
Chapter 9. The morning of November 20th, 1979. King Khaled indeed nursed a cold and rested in his Riyadh palace. The country's day-to-day ruler, Crown Prince Fahd, was not even on the same continent. When the sun crept up above Mecca, Fahd dozed in a Tunis hotel suite, thousands of miles and two time zones to the west. The reason Fahd had traveled to Tunis involved President Carter. Eager to get down in history as a peacemaker, Carter up until then had dedicated most of his energies in the Middle East to reconciling Arabs and Jews. In March 1979, following days of personal mediation by Carter at Camp David, Israel and Egypt finally signed a peace treaty, the first between Israel and an Arab country since the Jewish state's establishment 3 decades earlier. In exchange for recognition by Egypt, Israel agreed to surrender the vast Sinai Peninsula that it had seized in 1967. But the deal offered no tangible concessions for the Palestinians, whose fate had prompted Arab countries to go to war against Israel in the first place. Early in the negotiating process, Saudi Arabia had indicated to U.S. officials that it would support the peace agreement. But with Khomeini's revolutionary fervor inflaming anti-American sentiments in the region, the Saudi royals no longer felt it was safe to do Washington's bidding. The abandonment of the Shah had shown that Carter's America could not be relied upon to protect its allies. So, yielding to pressure from Yasser Arafat's Palestinian Liberation Organization and its hard-line Arab supporters, Riyadh joined a pan-Arab boycott of Egypt. Diplomatic ties with Cairo were ruptured, and the Cairo-based Arab League, having expelled the Egyptians, now moved to new quarters in Tunisia. On the night of the Islamic New Year, 14 Arab heads of state and countless lesser officials gathered in Tunis for the Arab League's annual summit to discuss the thorny problem of Egypt, the unfolding civil war in Lebanon, and the hardening Arab attitudes to America. At the summit, in Tunis's ritzy Hilton Hotel, Crown Prince Fahd was to play a crucial role. In tandem with Iraq's new president, Saddam Hussein, another voice of relative moderation in the region, the Saudi royal had to deflect Iranian-inspired pressure to punish America and the West with a resurrected Arab oil embargo. That pressure was ratcheted up by the arrival in Tunis of an uninvited Iranian delegation, headed, to the astonishment of the Saudis and the Iraqis, by none other than Ayatollah Hadi al-Madarasi, an Iraqi-born Shiite cleric who, after fleeing religious repression in his homeland, had been busy fomenting unrest among Shiites in other Arab Gulf states. Farsi-speaking Iran is not an Arab country and does not belong to the Arab League. Nevertheless, acting on Khomeini's instructions, this Iranian team, abetted by Arafat and Syrian President Hafez al-Assad, attempted to gain access to the august proceedings in the Hilton Hotel. The intruders were stopped just a few yards away by Tunisian guards who, despite their operetta-style helmets topped by white ostrich feathers, could be ruthlessly efficient when necessary. In Riyadh, the ailing King Khaled first learned the morning's terrible news from Sheikh Nasser ibn Rashid, the senior cleric in charge of the two holy shrines in Mecca and Medina. A devout Wahhabi who shared Juhayman's repulsion for graven images to such an extent that he always refused to be photographed, Ibn Rashid had personally checked out the Grand Mosque the previous night and found nothing unusual. Then, at about 6 a.m. Tuesday, he received his first frantic call from the Imam Ibn Subayl. There was no doubt in Ibn Rashid's mind that the matter was of utmost gravity. As Ibn Subayl relayed news from the mosque, frequent gunfire could be heard in the background. Because of his seniority among the ulema, Ibn Rashid enjoyed direct access to King Khaled. So after hanging up with the imam, he rushed to dial the king's palace in Riyadh. "It's an emergency," he insisted to the courtiers. "His Majesty must be put on the line right away." But His Majesty was resting and could not be disturbed, the courtiers tried to object. Ibn Rashid didn't give up, explaining the perils to which the Islamic sanctities had just succumbed. Minutes later, a groggy monarch picked up the receiver and listened to the shocking report. Jolted awake, he instructed the cleric to wander the streets and see for himself what exactly had just transpired. He also asked Ibn Rashid to try to locate the chief of Mecca's police.
The closest Ibn Rashid dared to approach the Grand Mosque was a barber shop near the Jihad Hospital, just south of the shrine. There he was briefed by a gaggle of excited onlookers. Spotting the police chief in the crowd, Ibn Rashid rushed to tell the officer to get in touch with the king. Then, since there was no way to call the royal palace from the barbershop, Ibn Rashid hurried back to his office.
From then on, King Khalid demanded that Ibn Rashid keep him informed of every development. The cleric ended up phoning the royal palace on some 30 occasions in the course of 1 hour.
Luckily, he had 2 phone lines in his office, so he could use one to receive updates while keeping the other for communications with his royal majesty. It occurred to Ibn Rashid in these hectic moments that the Prophet's mosque in Medina, the second holiest site of Islam, might be attacked by the same mysterious rebels now usurping the Kaaba. He phoned his representative in Medina, who in turn immediately informed the governor there, Prince Abdul Muhsin. On the prince's orders, the Prophet's mosque was cordoned off by armed police and its golden gates shut.
Pondering how to react, King Khalid had to make do without the 2 most senior members of the ruling household. Not just Crown Prince Fahd, the day-to-day ruler, was stuck in North Africa. The next in line to the throne, Prince Abdullah, commander of the all-important National Guard, was enjoying a holiday in Morocco. Even Prince Turki al-Faisal, the young head of the General Intelligence Directorate, GID, was unavailable. He had gone to Tunis with Fahd. The task of restoring the Grand Mosque to al-Saud's sovereignty fell to Fahd's 2 full brothers, the Interior Minister, Prince Nayef, and the Defense Minister, Prince Sultan. Roused from bed by a succession of increasingly nervous reports, they dropped everything and raced to Mecca, arriving in the Grand Mosque's vicinity by about 9 a.m. Joining them was a half-brother, Mecca's governor, Prince Fawaz. Finally getting their act together, Saudi police and security forces started taking up positions on Mecca rooftops and in the streets nearby, even though, amazingly, nobody had thought of stopping the traffic that still flowed right outside the Grand Mosque's perimeter. In the late morning, the first reinforcements began to arrive from Riyadh. A couple of companies from the recently established Special Security Force, a unit of Prince Nayef's Interior Ministry, flew to Jeddah and then drove to Mecca.
Leading these men was Major Mohammed Zuaid al-Nafai, a career army officer and a native of the Holy City, who, as it happened, belonged to the same Utebi tribe as Juhayman. Truckloads of men from the National Guard and the Saudi army also began rolling in.
These new forces started out by establishing a security cordon around the Grand Mosque, stopping traffic in the area and erecting checkpoints in the neighboring streets. The rebels could no longer count on supplies or reinforcements from the outside. The battle lines were drawn. Chapter 10. Driving straight toward these newly established checkpoints was Brigadier General Fala al-Tahiri, commander of the Saudi Army's King Abdulaziz Armored Brigade. Tahiri was in a good mood. He looked forward to the day's celebrations, and he planned to pray in the Grand Mosque at noon after a festive meal with his numerous Meccan relatives. Dressed in civilian clothes, Tahiri passed the familiar streets where everything looked normal. He rolled by the ancient excavations area near the center and then hit a surprise roadblock. Cursing about road maintenance, Tahiri tried an alternative street, but it was blocked too. "Why are both streets closed?" he asked a traffic policeman. The officer replied with a cryptic, "If you wonder, ask your boss. It's the Grand Mosque." Puzzled and feeling insulted, Tahiri pulled away from the checkpoint, determined to get downtown one way or another. Navigating a maze of side alleys, he emerged minutes later on the edge of the plaza facing the Grand Mosque's glistening marble under brilliant blue skies. The normally bustling area was strangely empty and quiet. The moment of Tahiri's arrival coincided with a long pause in the shooting. Spotting a lonely pedestrian, Tahiri halted him with a burning question. "Tell me, why are the gates of the Grand Mosque closed?"
"God knows," the pedestrian answered meekly.
"Of course, we all know that God knows this, but what do you know?"
"There have been some shots," the pedestrian volunteered. "They fired at the soldiers from the Grand Mosque."
"But why?"
God knows.
Frustrated, Tahiri moved on. Security officers lurked around a street corner, and he rushed to pepper them with more queries. The officers didn't seem to know much more. Their commander pointed to sniper nests atop the Grand Mosque's minarets.
"You're risking your life here," the officer said. "Above all, don't step into the middle of the street."
Tahiri's time, he suggested, could be much better employed by taking a short walk to the luxurious Shubra Hotel south of the shrine, where the senior princes had just assembled. Confused, Tahiri followed the advice.
"Where are the princes?" he asked at the entrance to the hotel.
Liverymen pointed to the first-floor reception area, where gun-toting bodyguards scrutinized all entrants. Mecca's chief of police, an old acquaintance, recognized Tahiri and waved him through into a lounge where the three senior princes now held court. Stunned by the agitation around, and by the illustrious presence of their royal highnesses, the brigadier listened to a short briefing about what was already known. The Grand Mosque had been seized by unknown assailants who appeared to be very successful in shooting police, for motives unclear. With respectful kisses of the royal shoulders, Tahiri presented himself to Prince Sultan and Prince Nayef.
"I am a professional military man," he began, offering his services in planning a quick and decisive raid on the sacred compound.
The princes listened with interest, eager for a quick end to this disgrace. Then the doors of the lounge were flung open. Wide-eyed, one of Tahiri's friends, a senior defense ministry bureaucrat named Saleh, burst inside. The bureaucrat had been to the Grand Mosque for dawn prayers and found himself taken hostage, along with tens of thousands of other worshippers. He had just managed to escape. Adrenaline pumping through his veins, Saleh told Prince Nayef and Prince Sultan how gunmen had seized the Kaaba. His tale brought into focus the religious nature of the uprising. Leading the rebels, he recounted, was a young man who claimed to be the blessed Mahdi, and who promised to fill with justice a world gone astray.
"What a blasphemy!" Saleh screamed.
Tahiri tried to calm him down, but to no avail. His friend broke down in near hysteria.
"These infidels! These blasphemers! These pigs!" he cried. "These murderers! Get rid of them for us, please!"
The religious claims of the rebels confounded al-Sa'd's internal security plans, honed over the years to protect the regime from socialist or Arab nationalist agitation. As the crisis developed, senior princes decided that the National Guard, rife with ultra-religious Bedouins, could not be trusted to fulfill its primary role of defending the regime, especially as long as the Guard's commander, Prince Abdullah, remained abroad. The traditionally suspect regular army had to be involved in rescuing the royal household from Juhayman's zealots. General Tahiri's armored brigade in particular was to play a key role in the battle ahead. News about the Mahdi traveled fast as more and more worshippers escaped from the Grand Mosque, some of them carrying Juhayman's epistles. "The Mahdi has arrived," merchants started telling each other with excitement in the Mecca bazaars and down the road in the sprawling conurbation of Jeddah. Visiting a government office in Jeddah that morning was Sami Angawi, an architect who, as a leading scholar of pilgrimage to the Grand Mosque, headed the Hajj Research Center of King Abdulaziz University.
Born into a prominent family of Meccan Ashraf, direct descendants of Prophet Muhammad, he was something of a rarity in the kingdom.
Despite Wahhabi pressure, he retained fidelity to Mecca's millennial tradition of mystical Sufi Islam, which preached love and harmony in the world and shunned the uncompromising zeal of the kingdom's religious orthodoxy. He also defied the Saudi-imposed uniform dress code, favoring an elaborate turban of a kind that used to be worn in Mecca before its conquest by al-Sa'd. Angawi's appointment was with the Director General for Water and Sewage Affairs to discuss the maintenance of the sacred Zamzam spring in the Grand Mosque's courtyard. As he walked into the meeting, radio equipment used for government communications lit up with urgent information.
"The Mahdi has appeared," the Director General said by way of greeting.
Angawi thought the bureaucrat was making a joke about his unusual turban, and he grinned in response.
"No, listen, it's for real, I am serious," the man insisted to an astonished Angawi. "The Mahdi has just come in the Grand Mosque in Mecca."
This information also started to seep across Saudi borders. A Moroccan pilgrim who had witnessed the seizure immediately called to alert the Moroccan embassy in Jeddah. By coincidence, the desk officer who received the call was a captain of Moroccan intelligence. He immediately passed the report to Morocco's King Hassan II. By another coincidence, when King Hassan II received the decoded message minutes later, he happened to be breakfasting with Prince Abdullah. The commander of the Saudi National Guard didn't deem the news of trouble in Mecca to be sufficiently important to require an immediate return. For now, he stayed put in Morocco. Expecting to oust the usurpers from the Grand Mosque in a matter of hours, and fearful that the takeover was part of a much greater conspiracy guided from abroad, the Saudi royals felt by mid-morning that they had to put an end to such information leaks. After all, what could be more embarrassing for Saudi Arabia's standing as a leader of the Islamic world, let alone Fahd's diplomatic mission in Tunis, than a failure to protect the Holy Kaaba? Already there had been occasional calls, in Iran and elsewhere, to take the holy places away from al-Saud and to put them under control of a neutral pan-Islamic body. This was no time for half measures. Before noon of November 20th, a Canadian phone company that managed international lines to Saudi Arabia was ordered to impose a total communications blackout. Not a single overseas phone call could be made, telex or telegram sent. Land borders were closed to non-Saudis. For all practical purposes, Saudi Arabia was severed from the rest of the world. On Saudi radio and TV, not a hint was broadcast about the drama in Mecca. The government kept total silence. This was not surprising. 11 years later, Saudi subjects would have to wait 3 days before finally being informed that Iraq had occupied Kuwait and had massed an armada on the kingdom's own borders. In the absence of reliable news, a torrent of fanciful rumors about the Mahdi's arrival engulfed the kingdom. When police sealed the Prophet's mosque in Medina that morning, the rumor mill churned out what seemed like a most logical explanation. The rebels, it was said, had also captured Islam's second holiest shrine. Inevitably, many Saudis, including soldiers just deployed to Mecca, started to wonder, what if this is all true? What if the blessed Mahdi has really emerged and the world as we know it is about to end? This avalanche of theological confusion undermined al-Saud's hopes of quickly recapturing the mosque. Absent a clear ruling from the respected ulema on what Islam's requirements are in such a highly unusual situation, many soldiers refused to point their weapons toward the Kaaba. Their oath of allegiance to the king, after all, had the all-important clause of obedience only in things that don't contradict God's will. But didn't Prophet Muhammad specifically prohibit warfare in the holy precinct and its vicinity, places of peace and devotion? Fighting in Mecca was not permitted for anyone before me, nor will it be permitted for anyone after me, the Prophet had declared, according to one hadith. It is not allowed for any of you to carry weapons in Mecca, he was quoted by another. Even in ancient times, didn't the Meccans rely on God, with his disease-spreading birds, to defend the Kaaba from the army of the elephant, without defiling the shrine with weapons themselves? Reconnaissance probes by small units drawn from newly arrived forces quickly ended in several fatalities as the soldiers were picked off from atop the minarets by Juhayman's invisible snipers. Even GID Chief Prince Turki, who managed to arrive in Mecca by late Tuesday night, negotiating his way past checkpoints, came close to being shot. At the Shubra Hotel, located on a street from which one of the minarets could be seen, a bullet shattered the glass front door that night, just as the Saudi spymaster turned the handle. Among ordinary soldiers, mounting casualties compounded the disarray. "Will I go to paradise as a martyr of Islam if I get killed today?" some soldiers wondered. "Or will I burn in hell for fighting in the shrine?" One account, probably apocryphal but indicative of the prevailing mood, tells of the defense minister Prince Sultan growing so frustrated by his men's disintegrating morale Tuesday afternoon that he threw his cloak to the ground in anger. Then the prince reportedly shouted at a group of Saudi soldiers in the mosque's vicinity, "If you do not fight to defend the house of God, who will? Do you want me to bring in Pakistanis to do the fighting in your place?" There was little that such emotional outbreaks could achieve. Al-Saud's authority to govern the kingdom rested on the family's Islamic credentials. With these credentials so dramatically and unexpectedly challenged by Juhayman, the royal family desperately needed its Islamic legitimacy reaffirmed. Such an endorsement could come from only one source, Juhayman's former teacher Bin Baz, and a coterie of bearded ulema who happened to share much of the rebels' worldview. Seeking a fatwa decree that would bless a military assault on the mosque, King Khalid that day issued orders to summon Bin Baz and 29 other senior ulema, including the shrine supervisor, Ibn Rashid, and the imam who had just escaped from the Grand Mosque, Ibn Subayl, to the Mazar Royal Palace in Riyadh. The clerics took their time to arrive, and once they gathered with the king, they made sure to drive a very tough bargain indeed. Chapter 11. As the Saudi state grappled with its worst security crisis in modern times, the American embassy, like all foreign missions accredited to the House of Saud, operated out of Jeddah instead of Riyadh. For decades, Al-Saud forbade infidels from staying overnight in the kingdom's conservative desert capital. By the 1970s, this restriction was lifted, but the royal family still preferred to transact most of its business with foreigners in opulent palaces on Jeddah's seashore. The diplomatic community was allowed to transfer to the capital only in 1984, and even then was largely segregated in a special embassy's neighborhood. A sweltering tropical city of anonymous concrete developments, Jeddah spreads along the Red Sea from a maze of crumbling white houses that predate Al-Saud's rule. Competing with each other in the elegance of their wooden latticework balconies, these mansions are made from coral that remains abundant in local waters. Their sophisticated decorations testify to the city's glorious history as a cosmopolitan crossroads. It is in Jeddah's seaport, and now airport, that most Muslim pilgrims disembark before making the journey to the sanctities of Mecca, and it is through Jeddah that they usually return after the Hajj. The drive across a lunar landscape of black rocks protruding from fine yellow sand, and through a checkpoint where the road ahead is marked with a large Muslims only sign, takes about an hour. For Ambassador West and other Americans based in Jeddah, the morning of November 20, 1979 started calmly. At a leisurely breakfast with Ohio Congressman Tony Hall, West delighted in presenting the visiting lawmaker with Arabian coffee pots and a King Solomon pendant to take home to the wife. To an untrained eye, there was no indication on Jeddah's sunlit, palm-fringed thoroughfares of the violent confrontation beyond the mountain ridge shimmering on the horizon. The first signs of trouble in Mecca that American diplomats received that morning came in anxious phone calls from Danish and British legations. The European diplomats had found themselves unable to communicate with their capitals. A Saudi phone operator told the British that the link to London was out of order and that the embassy should try again in 5 hours' time. Alarmed, the Americans immediately tried to phone the State Department and encountered a similar reply. The American embassy in Jeddah and the consulate in Tehran, however, also maintained an independent secure cable and phone link with the State Department. Saudi Arabia's communications blackout had a gaping hole. As embassy staff tried to figure out what had happened, Mark Hamley, a political officer and a rare Arabic speaker among Americans posted to Jeddah, received a tip from a Yemeni employee. The Yemeni, one of scores of non-Americans who worked in the embassy as cooks, drivers, or secretaries, usually commuted from Mecca. As he had left for work, the man told Hamley he had heard shooting from the area of the Grand Mosque. He did not know the exact reason. Intrigued, Hamley, whose brief included military affairs, let the CIA station know about such puzzling developments, and then began making inquiries of his own. Saudi contacts in a position to know either were impossible to track down or proffered highly implausible answers. "There's nothing going on in Mecca," said one. "It's just a training exercise," assured another. "There is a typhoid outbreak," went the most imaginative reply. In a different circumstance, an American diplomat or CIA agent would have hopped into a car and driven to the scene of reported unrest, gathering valuable first-hand information. But though tantalizingly close, Mecca was out of bounds to infidels. And in 1979, neither the CIA station nor the American embassy in Saudi Arabia employed any Muslims who possessed the required security clearances and could be entrusted with such a delicate mission.
As a frustrated Hambly kept scouring for tidbits of news from the Holy City, his phone rang. This was an unexpected conversation. The man on the other end of the line had an unfamiliar voice and spoke with an American accent. "I know you. You don't know me," he said. "I have information of great interest." Whatever he knew was too sensitive to be discussed on an open phone line tapped by Saudi intelligence. The caller, however, was ready to elaborate face-to-face a short time later, at Jeddah's Sands Hotel. Hambly, a round-faced 31-year-old from Idaho, who had already served at American embassies in Yemen and Libya, reflected on whom to take along to this encounter. He decided against involving the CIA. The agency and the State Department were in a perennial rivalry, and Hambly was miffed that the local CIA station had declined to reciprocate his early morning tip from the Yemeni staffer. Instead, Hambly walked down the corridor and into the office of Lieutenant Colonel Richard Ryer, the U.S. Air Attaché. At the Sands Hotel, a prefab building popular with Western expatriates, the mystery caller was waiting for Hambly and Ryer. Once the two American officials arrived, he started out by establishing his bona fides as Hambly's blood relative. In the early 20th century, Hambly's grandmother broke away from a devoted Seventh-day Adventist family. Decades later, her example inspired the defection of another relative in Michigan. Alone among more than a dozen siblings, this man, who should be called Dan in this book, left the fold and sought a new life outside the church. He flew UH-1 Huey choppers during the war in Vietnam. Then, drawn by Saudi Arabia's lucrative expatriate pay, he moved to the kingdom to fly the heavy twin-rotor Chinook helicopters for the Saudi civil defense. Dan knew from the grandmother that Hambly was also serving in Saudi Arabia at the time. Now, he told the startled diplomat, seemed like a good time to establish contact with his distant relation. The Civil Defense Force's task in ordinary times was to deal with fires, crowd control, and natural disasters, especially during the Hajj pilgrimage season. Qualified Saudi pilots were scarce, and so the Civil Defense Air Wing relied on American and British expats. Dan and his colleagues had to undergo a quick conversion to Islam in order to operate within Mecca's sacred boundaries. The conversion process was simple. All that was required of them was to utter in front of a witness the Muslim profession of faith. "There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is the prophet of Allah." Dan's new status as a Muslim did not prevent him and most fellow pilots from enjoying single malt scotch whenever a case could be procured from the American embassy, in spite of Muslim, or for that matter Adventist, prohibitions on alcohol. Dan had been roused this Tuesday morning at 6:30 a.m. at the helicopter wing's Jeddah base. The urgent order was to fly to the Mina area of Mecca, a couple of miles southeast of the Grand Mosque, and to pick up two Saudi intelligence officers for a reconnaissance sortie. Prince Turkey's GID lacked an air component of its own and needed the civil defense's choppers for a peek behind the Grand Mosque's outer walls. Dan and fellow pilots received only the briefest of explanations. Captain Alwani, the air wing commander, told them that the shrine had been taken over by the Iranians, a supposition caused by mistaking the rebels' Mahdist beliefs for the very different invocations of a Mahdi that pervades Shiite Islam. His Chinook, Dan told Hambly and Ryer, reached the Grand Mosque by 9 a.m. The shrine clearly seemed to be under rebel control. Two GID officers peered out of portholes as the chopper made a low pass near the mosque. Some 1,000 people remained in the open courtyard near the Kaaba. Much larger numbers lurked indoors and in the shadows of the mosque buildings. On the second overflight at around 11:45 a.m., as the chopper approached the northeast corner of the mosque, three distinct rifle shots were fired by the rebels. The aircraft surged skyward, performing evasive maneuvers. The courtyard, Dan jotted down, now for the first time appeared devoid of humanity. Dan brought along several photographs from the battle scene. This was most evidently not a typhoid outbreak. Thanks to pure luck and a convoluted family history, Hambly held in his hands a priceless piece of intelligence that would finally supply American policymakers with reliable information. The pilot was ready to provide more updates on condition that his collaboration was kept secret from Saudi authorities.
The three Americans agreed to meet again the following day, in a different hotel. By the time the sun rose across the Atlantic on Tuesday, other pieces of the puzzle fell into place. American diplomats managed to get hold of the Saudi military commander for the western region. American contacts informed the embassy that considerable traffic by C-130 transport planes ferrying troops had been spotted in Jeddah and Riyadh, and that Ministry of Defense hospitals had been put on full alert. Despite the hostage crisis, the United States still officially maintained diplomatic relations with Tehran. The Iranian embassy in Jeddah was contacted, too, to check out whether Khomeini's regime was involved. Iranian diplomats angrily denied all knowledge of the affair. With America's mission in Tehran already seized by Islamic revolutionaries, Ambassador West's thoughts quickly turned to protecting the American outpost in Jeddah from a similar fate. The Saudi National Guard beefed up its patrols around the embassy, which closed down all peripheral gates to the compound and suspended church services in the Chancery Auditorium. A lead and a chase car, filled with bodyguards, were added to the ambassador's security detail. Determined not to lose yet another trove of secrets in case of being attacked, American diplomats started to shred classified files. In Washington, all attention was already focused on Saudi Arabia's neighborhood. Gathering in the White House at 4 p.m. Eastern Time, late at night Saudi time, was a special meeting with the National Security Council dedicated to the escalating hostage standoff with Iran. Following mediation by the PLO, Khomeini had just released the Lucky 13, 5 female and 8 African-American male hostages. The Ayatollah magnanimously proclaimed that Islam respected women and that American blacks should not be seen as enemies of Islam because they too were being oppressed by the great Satan. As for the remaining hostages, Khomeini threatened to put them on trial for spying, darkly hinting that a likely penalty was death. The freed embassy workers, flown to Germany, shared tales of harsh treatment that appeared on the front pages of Tuesday morning's American newspapers. They had been kept with their hands and feet bound for 2 weeks, forbidden to speak, and subjected to psychological torture. Public outrage started to dent Carter's belief in a negotiated solution. The reason the National Security Council convened, 2 days ahead of Thanksgiving, was to explore ways of using American military might in the region. The president was ferried to the White House from his Camp David retreat aboard Marine One, and, precisely a minute before the meeting's scheduled start, strode into the cabinet room. America's most senior officials waited for him as they sat in tall leather chairs around an oval mahogany desk that had been donated by Nixon. Vice President Mondale was there, as were the National Security Advisor, Brzezinski, the Secretary of State, Cyrus Vance, and the Defense Secretary, Harold Brown. Hamilton Jordan, Carter's Chief of Staff, clutched a folder of secret telegrams he had just received about the newest flashpoint, Mecca. Carter was shaken by what he viewed as a spasm of political terrorism in Saudi Arabia, a country that he had visited the previous year and that had long piqued his curiosity. During that trip, Carter had been charmed by King Khaled, whom he remembered as quite excited and extremely talkative. On the way into Riyadh, the Saudi monarch had described to Carter his falcon hunting exploits, and then fed the American president camel milk and truffles he had personally excavated in the desert. Carter had been duly impressed by the king's common touch. Khaled followed the custom of holding an open court, the majlis, where any Saudi citizen could, in theory, come to state his grievances, and where ordinary Saudis were allowed to eat from the royal table. Among several classified telegrams on the disturbing upheaval in Mecca, a 3-page dispatch sent by Ambassador West laid bare the uncertainties. Embassy is continuing to receive information, some of it conflicting, concerning occupation of the Grand Mosque in Mecca. It is still not known for certain who is occupying the mosque, although it appears that they are very well armed, West wrote, citing testimony by the American chopper pilot. We have received reports indicating occupiers could be Iranian or Yemeni, although some reports from Saudi sources state occupiers are Saudi tribesmen supporting some as yet unidentified group of Islamic fundamentalists. This careful, hedged dispatch was superseded by a Defense Intelligence Agency notice issued 5 hours after West's telegram, and just 2 minutes before the National Security Council's meeting began. The attack on the holiest place of Islam, the Pentagon spy service explained categorically, had been perpetrated by a group believed to be Iranian. The world of Islam is now entering the month of Muharram, a period of great religious fervor among the Shiites. It is therefore quite likely members of the group holding the mosque are fanatic followers of Ayatollah Khomeini, the DIA said. A separate telegram by Ralph Lindstrom, the American consul general in Tehran, in the predominantly Shiite eastern province, appeared to back up the suggestion of Khomeini's involvement, citing the Aramco oil company. The news from Mecca, Lindstrom cabled, may be related to information we have just obtained from reliable company sources, recent Iranian attempts to agitate Saudi Shiites. Saudi authorities that year experienced unusual difficulty in keeping tabs on Iranians who had entered for the Hajj, the consul warned. Iranian pilgrim buses that headed for Mecca routinely arrived with only half the passengers who had crossed into Saudi Arabia at the border. The missing pilgrims turned out to be Arabic-speaking mullahs deployed by Khomeini as agitators, he wrote. With the lives of American hostages in Tehran on the line, and Khomeini looming large as Washington's public enemy number one, it was only natural that the mayhem in Mecca that day was seen by participants at the White House meeting as yet another Iranian provocation. In line with the DIA explanation, the working assumption became that the zealots in the Grand Mosque were Iranians, or Iranian-inspired Shiites. To keep Iran's ambitions in check as Mecca became a war zone, the Pentagon proposed at the White House meeting that afternoon to send to the Persian Gulf USS Kitty Hawk, a nuclear carrier with 85 aircraft aboard, accompanied by 5 ships that included a guided missile cruiser. USS Kitty Hawk was to join another battle carrier group led by USS Midway, and already in the Arabian Sea. Such a huge American presence, Defense Secretary Brown reckoned, would make vulnerable nations like Saudi Arabia feel more secure from Khomeini's Shiite subversion. Secretary Vance tried to oppose this deployment, arguing that sending USS Kitty Hawk to the Gulf would inflame Muslim sentiments and undermine chances of a peaceful solution for the hostage crisis. Carter, who usually sided with Vance's dovish instincts, this time felt compelled to start playing hardball. By late afternoon, the battle group was ordered to start sailing from Subic Bay in the Philippines. Briefing reporters on the decision, the State Department spokesman Hodding Carter III casually dropped the bombshell about some kind of disturbance that had occurred in Islam's holiest shrine. "There has apparently been kind of a seizure of a mosque by a group," he said. To the Saudis' lasting fury, their information blackout on the Mecca uprising was broken, most embarrassingly, by the American government, and without prior warning. In the Middle East, it was already the dead of night. Public outrage wouldn't begin until the morning. Though acknowledging the sketchiness of available information, Carter administration officials who spoke to the media sounded certain about the identity of the perpetrators. "Mecca mosque seized by gunmen believed to be from Iran," blared a front-page headline in the next morning's New York Times. The article cited an American official who explained that the militants in Mecca were responding to Khomeini's call for a general uprising by fundamentalist Muslims. America's Western allies embraced the same viewpoint. The British ambassador to Jeddah, Sir James Craig, reported that Tuesday in a confidential telegram to the Foreign and Commonwealth Office, "It is widely rumored in Jeddah that a group of Iranians stormed and occupied the great mosque in Mecca." In Israel, the foreign ministry, citing local Saudi watchers, also suggested that Khomeini's regime was involved and that the Mecca bloodshed did not signal internal unrest. This theory fit nicely with a new paradigm that began to take hold and that would dominate Western thinking about Islam for decades, with disastrous consequences. Shiites, because of Khomeini's appeal to this minority sect of Islam, were now deemed to be America's and the West's natural enemies. Majority Sunnis, including Wahhabi zealots, were by default seen as benign, if not outright friends. After Tuesday afternoon's meeting in the White House, President Carter returned from Washington to Camp David. A cinema fan, he watched after dinner with the First Lady a movie called Bloodline, an international thriller that starred Audrey Hepburn. it wasn't all gloom and doom. The depressing news from the Middle East, so far, had come with a silver lining. Despite the humiliation in Tehran, nobody was spilling American blood. Because of the Mecca events, this would change very soon. Chapter 12.
As the news of Mecca unrest broke in Washington, many among the 30 senior Saudi ulema finally assembled in King Khaled's Mazar Palace. Rounding them up had been an arduous process. Several had had to be transported to Riyadh on special flights from other parts of the kingdom.
Not all could attend. The one member of the ulema council with the most direct involvement in the day's events, the Grand Mosque Imam Ibn Subayl, was so traumatized by the upheaval that he stayed put in the holy city. Shuffling in their leather sandals and adjusting their drooping headdress, the ulema walked on maroon wall-to-wall carpeting and placed themselves on gold-laced armchairs, exchanging excited comments. Bin Baz, unable to see, had to be helped in by a respectful aide.
King Khaled, after mandatory praises to the Lord, opened the meeting. He recounted how the rebels had bolted the gates of the mosque, demanded allegiance to a so-called Mahdi, and then fired on people inside and outside the shrine, killing innocent Muslims.
Now, the king wanted to know, what should his soldiers be doing? Everyone was aware of the Islamic injunctions against combat in the House of God. What did the learned ulema suggest to preserve the sanctity of the holy place, where the depraved intruders had now stopped the regular prayers and halted the circumambulation of the Kaaba? Before debating the royal request, the clerics had to make a determination. Did the invaders' claim of being led by a Mahdi have any merit?
Ibn Rashid, the sheikh who supervised the Grand Mosque's affairs and who had awoken King Khaled in the early morning, recalled that in previous years he had arrested several unbalanced people who had come to the shrine declaring themselves to be Mahdi.
The man stirring up trouble in the holy precinct today, he believed, was most certainly an impostor. A real Mahdi, after all, would not be killing and terrorizing innocent worshippers.
Summoning their memory of the hadith, Ibn Rashid and the other ulema agreed that the preconditions of the true Mahdi's arrival, as spelled out by the prophecies, had not yet been fulfilled.
Among the missing pieces they noted was that the 70,000 Jews whom the Mahdi and Jesus Christ would destroy had been described by the prophecy as wearing shawls and coming from Isfahan. But Isfahan and Khomeini's Iran no longer had such a large Jewish community. And what about the walls of Damascus, with their several gates, behind which the Mahdi would hide awaiting Jesus' aid? Didn't everyone know, Ibn Rashid wondered, that today's Damascus was no longer surrounded by walls?
Having rejected the notion that they might be dealing with a true Mahdi, the clerics moved on to debating King Khaled's request for a fatwa.
Unlike the American government, the ulema knew very well that Khomeini's misguided Shiites had nothing to do with the drama in Mecca. It seemed clear by now that the invaders belonged to a Wahhabi missionary movement that Bin Baz and other senior ulema themselves had helped to start. In fact, it was the same movement that had mushroomed under their eyes and that they had determined to be innocuous just more than a year ago. These idealistic young men couldn't fail to evoke some sympathy among the ultra-conservative guardians of Wahhabi propriety. After all, the Grand Mosque's sermon that morning had lamented the kingdom's decaying morale, making the same complaints about spreading infidel mores and tolerance for women's immodesty that the ulama themselves voiced so frequently with the king. And what about the blistering criticism leveled by Juhayman against Prince Fahwaz, the liberal governor of Mecca? Hadn't the ulama also mentioned to His Majesty in the past that Fahwaz sullied the image of al-Saud with his tolerance for alcohol and the mixing of sexes, turning the holy city into a den of iniquity? Wasn't it inevitable that such laxity in enforcing the laws of Islam would prompt some hot-headed young men to take matters into their own hands as they sought to uphold the only true faith? There was only one way forward, Bin Baz and the other senior ulema decided. The House of Saud, despite all its failings, had to be shored up in its hour of need.
As King Khaled requested, they would sign a fatwa, reaffirming the regime's Islamic legitimacy. But from now on, the Saudi rulers would have to live up to their Islamic obligations.
There should be no more women on TV. No more licentious movies. No more alcohol. The social liberalization that had begun under King Faisal should be halted and, where possible, rolled back. And billions of Saudi petrodollars should be put to good use, spreading the rigid Wahhabi Islam around the planet. Wasn't it Saudi Arabia's duty to dispel the clouds of disbelief, instilling genuine faith among Muslims worldwide, and spreading God's word among infidels? As some Saudi princes described it later, the ulema essentially asked El Saud to adopt Juhayman's agenda in exchange for their help in getting rid of Juhayman himself. As is often the case in the kingdom, this quid pro quo was implied and not necessarily enshrined in clear, unambiguous words. But nobody questioned the meeting's outcome. The royal household accepted the bargain. It's unclear how much time these negotiations required. It took 3 long days for the requested fatwa to be composed, signed by all 30 ulama, and released. But King Khalid already felt secure about a commitment from bin Baz and key clerics by the early morning of Wednesday, November 21st. He immediately called Mecca to inform the interior minister, Prince Nayef. 24 hours after the siege of the Grand Mosque began, the Saudi government finally decided that it could tell its own citizens about it. Riyadh Radio treated listeners to an unscheduled program of religious poetry and songs, and then, at about 5 a.m., broadcast a short statement by Prince Nayef's Ministry of the Interior. As Juhayman had predicted, he and his acolytes were described as Kharijites, a loaded word that referred to the ancient sect that killed the Prophet's son-in-law Ali, and that would be translated by the Saudis as renegades or deviators from Islam. The statement consisted of only 4 sentences. A handful of deviators infiltrated the Holy Mosque with arms and ammunition during the early morning prayer Tuesday, the first day of the first month of Hijra, year 1400. They presented someone to the worshippers in the mosque to perform morning prayers, pretending that he was the expected Mahdi, and urged them at gunpoint to recognize him as such, the document said. The authorities concerned took all necessary measures to control the situation after procuring a fatwa from the ulema to protect the lives of Muslims inside the mosque. The Ministry of the Interior will issue a subsequent statement on developments in the situation. The ulema themselves remained conspicuously silent. No word was heard directly from bin Baz or from other senior clerics. During the night, while the ulema conferred in Riyadh, Juhayman and his closest aides retreated to an underground area that became their headquarters. These basement-level galleries, the Kabu, were crammed with supplies. The rebels stocked up on the high-calorie staples of desert survival. Dates, flatbread, and a filling dried yogurt paste known as ikut. The holy well of Zamzam provided more than enough drinking water for everyone. So far, everything had seemed to go well for the conspirators. They were encouraged by the ease of seizing the mosque and the tepid government reaction thereafter. Whatever qualms some may have had about Muhammad Abdullah's status as Mahdi had now disappeared. From the original tens of thousands of hostages, a sizable minority still remained in the mosque. Juhayman's conspirators rounded up scores of poor African pilgrims, men who often stayed behind in Mecca for the lowliest of jobs, and essentially turned them into slaves, tasked with carrying ammunition and water. One group of 120 Yemeni pilgrims, most of whom failed to understand the Mahdi speech and heard only gunshots during the sermon, was told to sit near the Kaaba and forbidden to move throughout Tuesday. Their pleas for water or food were ignored. Other basic needs were also difficult to satisfy. Public toilets for worshippers visiting the mosque were located outside the compound, in territory now under government control. A few rooms inside the mosque had to be converted into temporary latrines. The stench of urine quickly spread through the shrine's corridors. Even among those allowed to leave the compound, not all could handle the difficult escape route through the windows of the mosque's lower gallery. The old and the infirm had to remain once the main gates were chained shut. "All I can do is lie down," one exhausted 75-year-old Indian pilgrim, Mohammed Staj, told the militants as he refused to move. With power lines into the compound severed, the Grand Mosque, always bathed in bright light,
was plunged into forbidding darkness on Tuesday night, becoming a giant black hole in the heart of the city. Soldiers could no longer see Juhayman's men, while the rebels enjoyed a perfect field of vision into the surrounding streets. Snipers positioned on top of the minarets continued to score regular hits on government soldiers who tried to observe the goings-on in the sacred compound from Imarat al-Ashraf, the tallest building near the mosque, which had now become the military's operational headquarters, and from other vantage points on nearby hillsides.